You're listening to Wavelength with William English on Resonance 104.4 FM. And today's programme is a recorded interview with David Curtis, author of Experimental Cinema, published in 1971, and A History of Artists, Film and Video in Britain, published in 2007. David organised screenings at the Drury Lane and Robert Street Arts Labs and then became film officer at the Arts Council from 1977 until 2000. Since then, he has founded the British Artists Film and Video Study Collection at Central St Martins. Is that all right so far?
Pretty much true.
Good. We're away then. Okay. Well, we're in an office in St Martin's College of Art on the Charing Cross Road, London, next door to Foyle's Bookshop, where in 1929 a workshop was held, organised by the Film Society and attended by Eisenstein, Len Lai, Basil Wright and others. In the other direction, at the corner of New Compton Street and Charing Cross Road, was the site of Better Books, where the London Filmmakers Co-op first appeared in 1966. And then, of course, St Martin's College, between the two, where the first fine art film course was set up in 1972, and which is now the home of the Artists Film and Video Study Collection. Why do you think this particular area is so rich in experimental film folklore, if we can call it that?
I don't know, you missed one out, which is that Bottoms had its premiere in the Little Cinema, which is right next door to St Martin's, in 1966.
Oh, right.
It was a cinema programmed by Anthony Balch, and Anthony Balch was a friend of Yoko Ono, and so when she wanted a place to show her Bottoms film, that's where it premiered, so yet more. I don't know why this area, I suppose simply because Moving Image has always been located in Soho since the very beginning.
Right. Yes. But I suppose there's also a connection with the Charing Cross Road bookshops, maybe, because you've got this sort of strip of where bookshops were.
Yeah.
Because there is a sort of connection with poets, isn't there?
Yes, Bob Cobbing, who, in a sense, was the true founder of the London Filmmakers Co-op, was manager of Better Books on that corner of Old Compton Street, New Compton Street, Charing Cross Road. So books was very much his passion.
Yeah, so there's a sort of link then between books and the Soho film production, but although I don't really suppose that Soho film production had anything to do with the experimental film scene, did it really? I mean, was there any spin-off from that? Or,
well, I think the Film Society. I mean, you're going back way beyond my ken, really, but I write about it in the book. But the Film Society had its base in the bottom of Regent Street and in the Strand. There were big cinemas that it booked once a month all through the 20s, and the Film Society's audience comprised film directors from the industry, people like Basil Wright and so on, who were editors in the industry, Willie Coldstream, who was an artist kind of moonlighting as an editor in the in the industry and so on.
Is that William Coldstream, the painter?
Yeah.
But he was a film editor as well.
Yes, he edited Nightmare. I mean, he was one of the editors of Nightmare. Oh. He edited all sorts of stuff. He didn't survive very long in the industry. Right. He writes rather touchingly about the kind of the poverty of the imagination of a lot of the people in the film world, and that in a sense that tension between kind of creative artists and their interest in the moving image and the kind of industry heavyweights. It's a tension that kind of carries on all through the 20s and the 30s. It sort of gets buried in the 60s when I got interested. I mean, there was a real division at that stage, I think, between the emerging avant-gardists and the film heavyweights. Though a lot of us, I think, who were interested in the emerging avant-garde in the 60s were also interested in art cinema at that time. I mean, we did go and see the new Godard films, the new Truffaut films, etc.
Right. So would that have been the Academy on Oxford Street?
The Academy on Oxford Street, the JC in the Strand, I can't remember. There were loads of little cinemas. There were certainly 10, 15 cinemas in the West End that regularly showed subtitled films. And I mean, that sounds completely impossible these days, but that was the case in the 60s.
Yeah.
So there was a serious film culture at that time. But the avant-gardists tended to be art students, and a lot of them were not so interested in cinema's mainstream. So, you know, that tension between those who were interested and those who weren't,
yes,
I think existed even then.
Yes. Well, I suppose it's the case that I suppose artists' film tended to be produced by people with a background in either painting or music rather than cinema, wasn't it? Usually the cinema people would go off in a different direction. And for the most part, I suppose, they were probably fairly contemptuous of the of avant-garde film. Is that too strong or...? Critical? I know that when I went to the London Film School, for example, I mean, the bias there was definitely towards the industry.
Yes.
And it was all about getting into the film industry, really.
Yeah.
And apart from showing sort of... I mean, they literally sneered at the avant-garde. They'd call it the so-called avant-garde, you know, as though it was going in the wrong direction or something.
Quite often there was a meeting ground in terms of politics.
Right.
Because I remember you talking about the London School of Film Technique, whatever it was called at that time. There were a number of people who came out of that who were politically involved, and it was interesting when Le Gris started his film workshop in the Arts Lab in Drury Lane. Some of the people who helped him build it were from the London School of Film Technique. There's an American called Ben Yaya, is the only name I can call off the top of my head. But there were two or three people, and they, you know, their interest was that this was a way of processing your film without taking it to the film labs, in order that you could avoid censorship. And there was a real paranoia at that time about, you know, taking politically sensitive material to the film labs in case they kind of fed it to the police, the CIA, whoever it was supposed to be watching over their shoulders.
Yeah.
And the interesting kind of coincidence of interest there between those who wanted to avoid censorship for image reasons, showing sexual images on screen and so on, they tended to be the avant-gardists.
So maybe the connection with Soho was useful then, in that case.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So, what was your first? I mean, you studied painting, didn't you, at the Slade?
Yeah.
Originally,
I was always interested in cinema, though. I mean, that the Slade had a film department, which was a film studies department rather than a filmmaking department, set up by Thorold Dickinson, somebody who'd been involved in the film society in the '20s. You know, he was an old chum of Coldstream's from the film societies, basically. Dickinson had, I think, was the first university to set up a film studies course. All sorts of interesting people, Ray Dergnat, who was an early co-op member and a wonderful writer on cinema, was a student there. Lutz Becker was a student there. Lutz, who became a kind of expert in Eisenstein and people like that, but... who else was there? I can't remember. Peter Whitehead was there, I think borrowing equipment more than anything else, but just using it.
Yeah.
So there were makers there by default. Mm-hmm. But basically it was a studies department where you could look at classics of world cinema and so on. Dickinson had these extraordinary contacts. He knew people like Renoir personally, Fritz Lang, he knew all these people, again, probably from the 20s and 30s when they were part of that kind of film society network. So he was able to kind of call in prints of things that were not in distribution. And so we had a wonderful education. I say we, I was a painting student, but I would go to the screenings that happened at sort of 6 every evening in the film studies department. Our studios shut because the daylight had faded at 5 or something. So
when was this?
This is early 60s.
Right.
I was at Slade from 61 to 65, something like that.
Right. So you would have been about 20 or so at this time.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was one education. Another education was that there were new films by Fellini and Bergman and people like that playing in the West End the whole time.
Yeah.
So I would see, you know, classics of the 20s and 30s through Thorold Dickinson screenings at the Slade in the evening, and then I would often go off to a new Godard film in the Paris Pullman or something like that.
Oh, okay. So you were an avid cinema guy.
I was a real cinephile. I went at least 3 times a week.
Right. Mm. Okay. So was there a point at which you gave up painting or and veered towards cinema?
No, when I left the Slade, I cannot remember how I encountered the Film Corp screenings, but I was one of the kind of people who went to the Film Corps from its very beginning in Better Books.
So you went there just as a viewer? You weren't part of the
I wasn't part of the administration, so to speak, no. But my first job out of the Slade was I taught painting in Birmingham, College of Art. Birmingham College of Art turned out to be rather sort of traditional art college, although this guy called William Gear there, who I discovered later on, was a sort of bit of a British cubist or something.
Yeah.
But he was quite hostile to sort of modernity, it struck me. And one of my rebellious acts was that I showed the films that the Film Corp was showing in Better Books, I showed them in Birmingham College of Art on my sort of, you know, 2-day-a-week teaching stint there.
Okay.
So I got involved in that. I sort of almost simultaneously got involved in the UFO club, Hoppy's underground club that he set up slightly further up Tottenham Court Road, which was, I don't know, was
again,
it?
So that's just up the road, isn't it?
Yeah.
100 yards or so up.
Yeah. That means that by then I had met, and I cannot remember when I met, Jim Haynes. Certainly from the middle of the 60s, Jim was in London running a sort of branch of his Traverse Theatre from Edinburgh in the Cochrane Theatre, became part of Central St Martin's these days, part of the Central School building. But he borrowed that from time to time and ran performances there. And Jim was in London. He was a close friend of Hoppy's and all the rest of you. He was involved in the International Times, the underground newspaper of that time. And through Jim, I think I met Hoppy and got involved in the UFO Club. I screened whatever there was that in the nature of sort of underground films at the UFO Club, as almost as a kind of light show. Mark Boyle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I shared a platform projected on top of the soft machine when it was playing one direction. And simultaneously there would be the Birth of the Nation running backwards or upside down, projected by me in the other direction. And various other people projected all sorts
of things. So these were your own creative decisions. You'd say to yourself, let's project Birth of a Nation upside down or something.
In the extremis I resorted to that sort of thing. But basically I think Hoppy had said to me, you know, show whatever you can. You know, I've heard of these funny things by Kenneth Anger. Can you get me prints of those and we'll show those? So I did show kind of classic avant-garde stuff.
Right.
But there was very little of it around. I mean, later on, when I got involved in the Filmmakers Co-op, I remember with John Collins compiling a list of all the avant-garde films in distribution in England. And it was on one foolscap sheet. Words, kind of a column of about 50 titles. Yeah. That was going through the BFI's catalogue and Connoisseur Films catalogue and Contemporary Films catalogue, picking out the one or two brackages that they had. And
so each of these distributors might have
one or two things that they picked up, I think, through Amos Vogel's attendance at festivals in Europe all through the 50s and 60s when he was setting up Cinema 16.
Right.
I think he brought programmes of stuff.
And how would you know which ones to... I mean, how were you getting the knowledge, as it were, this time?
That's a very good question.
Was it by word of mouth or kind of...
I think it was by word of mouth. Mm. When did Sheldon Rannan's book on the underground...
67, I think.
Okay, so that wasn't much...
I remember that was the first book I bought.
That was a kind of confirmation of the pantheon, I guess. But
yes, it was. I mean, before that... I mean, there was Sequence magazine.
Yeah, I didn't read that.
No. Right, okay, so you didn't bother with that.
I think it was word of mouth, I think, basically.
So you must have been associating, then, perhaps, with other people who maybe people from America?
I tell you what, I went to New York in... the year I graduated from the Slade, so maybe 65, 66, I went to New York because I had read about Andy Warhol films and Jonas Mekas's activities there. And from that first visit in 66, I started subscribing to Village Voice, and I had it sent over to me. It arrived intermittently. It didn't always come. I missed various issues.
Yeah.
But I read his column, the Jonas Mekas's.
Right, okay. Okay.
Sort of diary column that yeah. and where he wrote wonderfully in those early days about things yeah. that he'd seen.
Yes.
So I knew about Jack Smith and all that lot.
Right, right.
Prince did turn up in London at that time. Flaming Creatures turned up in London at that time.
How would it turn up, do you think? I mean, how would it just sort of arrive?
Somebody brought Prince into the ICA in 65 or something like that. Jonas Mekas had been to the Nokkelzoot Film Festival in 64 or something like that,
right.
bringing American films with him.
Mm.
And I was just reading Jonas's account of a huge collection of American, sort of new American cinema, which turned up in Spoleto in Italy in 1961, I think, or 62, which already had things by Kenneth Anger and Markopoulos and so on.
I see. Okay.
I'm not entirely sure about the date of that. But,
mm.
So there had been sort of trickle of American things coming to Europe all through the 50s and 60s.
Okay, so you were organising screenings then, to some extent, the UFO Club and
yes.
The Arts Lab?
Yes, the UFO Club, I can't remember when that finished, but the Arts Lab opened, I think, in 66 in Drury Lane. And extraordinarily ambitiously, we kind of ran a seven-day-a-week programme. Actually, no, I think we were closed one day a week, but, often two screenings a night. And given there was so little experimental work around, certainly so little British experimental work, we recycled what was available through the different distributors here. But we also depended a great deal on visiting Americans and people like Mike Snow. Mike Snow came and showed Wavelength. He went to the Nokkelzoot in 66-67, which I also went to, where a whole lot of people like Paul Sharitz and
so would you have gone off your own bat then? You just thought, I want to go and see this festival. You were kind of literally pursuing it.
I'd become fairly single-minded by this stage.
Right.
And it clearly was the place to be at that moment.
Hmm.
And it was. I mean, the 66, 67, it always happened over the new year. I mean, it started the 29th of December or something and ended on the 2nd of January. So it spans 2 years.
Right.
But the 66-67 one was extraordinary. There was a small contingent of us who came from England, Bob Cobbing from the Filmmakers Co-op, classically, with, I can't remember who, John Collins and one or two others who were associated with the Co-op at that time, John Latham, because he'd made his wonderful film Speak, and he showed that there. Jeffrey Shaw, who became associated with ZKM later on in Germany, and great new media guru who's there with doing huge inflatables of projection going on into them. But Birgit Hein was there from Germany. But I guess Steve Dvoskin was there from England. Who else? Ray Dergnat was there, I think, wearing his critic's hat.
So what about, during this period, what were your own creative activities?
I wrote a bit.
That's not to say that organising isn't a creative activity.
No,
but you were studying painting.
By this, there came a moment when my involvement in setting up the Arts Lab with Jim Hames, I mean, we physically built the cinema in the basement there. Biddy, my partner, ran the gallery there. Barry Miles, his wife Sue, ran the restaurant. And Jim ran the bookshop. Jack Moore ran the theatre. And there was a lot of kind of overlap activity. Literally, as that place opened, I gave up my job in Birmingham, which was a kind of huge leap in the dark because we had no grants. I mean, there was no public funding of the Arts Lab or anything like that at all. I remember the rent was £90 a week, which seemed like a fortune. And we had to cover that by admissions and memberships. People who came into the Arts Lab had to be members. But the cinema very quickly became the most regular income-generating source for the building because we were running programs right around the week. The gallery sold nothing, basically. We had a John Lennon exhibition there. John and Yoko, but John's contribution was the front of a drawer which had fallen off, which he'd found somewhere, which he and Yoko came to install it, and said, "Oh no, we don't want a plinth. It's just got to be placed on the floor in the middle of the gallery without a label or anything else."
Right.
And so Billy spent a great deal of her time kind of trying to get people not to tread on this completely inconspicuous object lying on the floor. But clearly, you know, it didn't sell, nothing sold. Right. In the cinema, I'd say there were not that many experimental films to show in the programme. We did show anything that we could lay our hands on, and people like Markopoulos did pass through London, and we did do screenings of their work. But a lot of the cinema programme was flying down to Rio and kind of musicals and things like horror films run all through the night as whatever, and that did earn some money for the Arts Lab.
Was it ever your intention to make films yourself at this time?
I did.
I seem to remember reading somewhere that you... I don't know where
it was. I did. I mean, there's an early Co-op catalogue that has some entries by me.
Right.
I don't think any of them were really that serious.
16mm?
So I did. I made sort of 16mm films, but sort of borrowing things. I mean, there were people who came. We had all sorts of people who were sort of industry practitioners, you know, cameramen, people like that from the industry who were Arts Lab devotees, and one could call on them to shoot things. I remember shooting a sequence of tracking through the forest in Epping Forest, just because I wanted kind of a long shot of trees moving around. I can't remember for what film or whether it ever materialised into anything. Later on, sort of probably inspired by Mikas and others, I started doing sort of Super 8 diaries, really standard 8 diaries.
Right.
So there's lots of embarrassing footage of us skipping around. Actually, I've got a wonderful record of going to New York with Simon Field in 1969 or 70 when we were planning the Underground Film Festival.
Yeah. So you were shooting sort of diaristic footage?
Yeah, you know, so single framing stuff very much in the Mikas.
Yeah, yeah. And did it have were they screened?
Probably, yes, but not very gloriously.
So where are they now, these films? Do you still have them?
I probably still have them.
And any intention of screening them again?
No.
No?
Well, I don't know.
They must be fascinating. They would be. They would be. They'd be really interesting, I'm sure.
Yes.
They should be seen.
Yes, definitely.
No, seriously. No, really, they should be. I mean, what... You know,
I'll embarrass my children with
So how many hours of footage have you got?
Oh, I don't know. Not a lot.
No? Okay.
No.
All right.
But there is some.
All right. And did you ever imagine that you might make films? I mean, in terms of getting, you know, becoming a filmmaker yourself?
I don't know. I mean, curiously, I enjoyed recording bits and pieces. I enjoyed making the kind of diary films.
Mm.
Partly because they're a way of interacting with people, there are things like film editing, which I think is, you know, something which I find an extraordinary art and very fascinating. And yet, I never felt personally engaged when making films in that aspect of it. And that's kind of, I think, that told me that I am not a natural born filmmaker.
Mm. Alright.
And I still occasionally paint, so I mean, painting is something that's not completely gone away, and I suspect that if I seriously return to being creative at any stage in my life, it would probably be in terms of making still images rather than moving ones.
Right. Okay. But I suppose the role of curator and enabling
programming, I think. I remember somebody that it was Carla Liss at the Robert Street Arts Lab, and Malcolm and I did an extraordinary programme, which was largely put together by me, of kind of film as information. It was Malcolm's early kind of materialist interests. We did a film programme putting together scientific films and bits of avant-garde footage and all sorts of things. And I remember Carla coming up to me afterwards saying, you know, I didn't realise how creative film programming could be until I saw this program.
Right.
And I think that's right. I mean, I think I actually have had various moments in my life kind of quite... well, I've enjoyed the experience of putting improbable films together and seeing, and seeing how they work.
Yeah.
So that's
the
closest I get to film editing.
Right. Okay.
And that's, it is creative.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I suppose, I mean, many people did come and go from the film scene, didn't they? I mean, often people would come and go for 2 or 3 years, but you have consistently remained with it now for how long is it? It's certainly more than 40.
40 years. 40 years.
It's 40 years.
Yeah. I've been incredibly lucky in that. People have often pointed this out to me, I've been incredibly lucky in that I was paid, and have been paid most of my life, to be interested in this area of work.
Yeah.
It's an incredible privilege. How many people have actually been paid by the taxpayer, in fact, in both cases, both at the Arts Council and here. I mean, I live by the seat of my pants, which is how artists live during the Arts Lab years, which is... 6 years, 7 years.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, even then, I supported myself by working for Derek Hill's New Cinema Club for part of the time, and I supported myself by working for Jimmy Vaughan's Vaughan Rogerson Films.
Oh, yeah.
He was Warhol's distributor and Anger's distributor for a while, and I wrote their catalogues for them and did things like that. So even during the lean years of working at the Arts Labs, I was able to kind of drop into proper paid work when I needed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I have been lucky.